Find and learn from people who lived it wherever you get podcasts. Search it using all one word. Learn from people who lived it.
Welcome to another episode of Learn from People Who Lived It.
Hi, my name is Clay Jones, and I'm 62 years old.
Clay, what story are you here to share today?
My story is the subject of my memoir. It's called My Sister's Brother. It's the story of growing up as the youngest child in a family with two parents that were deeply troubled by alcohol and other issues and resulting child abuse that has lifelong effects.
Who do you hope hears our conversation today?
This is really affects everyone, but more specifically, the subject of domestic violence per se. We tend to think of it as male perpetrator, female survivor, victim. And the reality is it's a very complicated subject and there's different facets to it. And one of those involves men actually as survivors under maybe a different kind of domestic violence that we might think of partner. In this situation, I was actually the youngest child of a family where my oldest sister, who was really the only person I was close to, was sexually abused from the age of 8 until she was about 20, all unbeknownst to me. She was 12 years older than me and lost her life prematurely and has had effects on my lifelong in many ways, professionally, personally, physically, and everything. So man. I think it's really about men or boys that are affected by these kinds of issues as well as women.
I can't wait to get into this conversation today. Dave, we talk about this so many times about how those big T's and little T's, man, when they hit us, they have a lifelong impact on everything that is to do with us, you know, and how we operate. And so, Clay, welcome to our podcast. Dr. David, welcome to our podcast. How are you?
Hey, pleasure to be here as always.
Yeah. Well, Clay, let's jump right into our conversation today. We're here in the spirit of helping other people feel less alone. And so one of the things that we love to do on Learn from People Who Lived It is start with the first 10 years of people's lives. It gives us a pretty good look into the operating system that got set up within you. So talk about that from 30,000 foot view and zoom in where you feel like it. But, you know, from 0 to 10, what's your story? What's happening with you?
Yeah, great question. So I'm the youngest. My parents, it was their second marriage for both of them. They both had children from previous marriage. So those are half siblings of mine. Those folks were like typically around 30 years older than me. Most I never hardly knew. So grew up with my mom, my dad, my sister Becky, 4 years older, and my older sister Linda, the protagonist of my life story here. She was 12 years older than me. I was born in New Jersey. When I was 5, we moved to Los Angeles. When I was 7, we moved to Sao Paulo, Brazil for 3 years. When I was 10, we moved to Monterrey, Mexico for 2 years. When I was 12, we moved back to a rented house in Los Angeles. And when I was 13, back to our family home in Los Angeles. So by the time I was in fifth grade, around that 10 or years, so I lived in 3 countries in about 9 different places.
Looking back on it now, I moved around a lot as a kid too, but I actually refer to a couple of those moves as the moves I never knew I needed. And they were really good for me. There was a couple of moves that we made that were super for me. They weren't all easy. Some of them were tough. What was your experience like in those cases, Clay?
Right. I greatly, greatly value those experiences, especially in Brazil. We were expats living this kind of middle-class existence in a world of extremes of wealth and poverty like we cannot even imagine here. And for the last 25 years, I worked in the field of social work and child abuse prevention. And so it's really given me insight into appreciating all that we have here and the circumstances at which probably most of the rest of the world lives in conditions. We're angry when our cable TV goes out and we blow a fuse, you know, and I'm like, really? So from a very young age, again, 7 years old when we moved to Brazil, learned Portuguese, went to an English-speaking school, but became fluent in Portuguese and was really immersed in that culture. So many, many positives. The downside to that was never had long-term friends. And even as an adult, after living in Arizona for some 20 years, I realized I didn't have any friends here for very long because that was just part of my DNA at that point of not getting attached to people in that way. You're going to move So,
Dr. Dave, I want to bring you in right now, man, and talk about that, because that is one of those things, right? When you move around a lot, you don't get to sharpen that tool of how to meet people and how to stay with them.
Well, there's pluses and minuses to it. I think the benefit of moving a lot as a kid is you learn how to get established quickly. You know, you could pop in someplace and learn how to make friends, learn how to talk with people, you know, where other people might have a slow time warming up. You know, so out of necessity, it kind of forces you to get established quickly. But the downside is, you know, maybe not wanting to get close with people if the first couple of separations was difficult.
Do you remember how you felt towards your parents in those moments, Clay? Because I write about it in my upcoming book, that when I was 12 years old and they told us we were moving to St. Louis, it was the most angry I've ever been at my mother and father. Did you ever have that experience, or were you always like, all right, sure, where are we going next?
That's right, option B. Yeah, I was not angry. I never felt attached or connected to them, but I didn't realize that. This is the weird thing about looking back in this. I was just a loner. I grew up as a loner. And we talk about family roles, the problem child, the golden child. This, you know, I was kind of the lost child, if you will. And so I was content with that and you know, didn't feel attached to them. And now looking back on that, it's difficult to have you write about a negative, write about something that did not exist.
Yeah, sure. So let's do this. We spent a couple of minutes talking about some of the things that were tougher, that were harder, that were instrumental in developing you. But were there bright spots to your childhood too? Were there great things about your dad and mom and the relationships there too? Or just none to be found?
Right. Probably more, not much to be found. I describe my mom as intoxicated, laughing, happy mom. And dad is kind of screaming, drunk, alcoholic dad. So they were kind of at opposite ends of that. I was never physically abused, but my dad would scream his shame on you routine on me, which I write about descriptively as a 10-year-old, what that felt like. It's just from another world, seemingly. So yeah, just didn't feel attached to either one of them, but left to my own devices, you know, made my own way. If I was ever hurt, I could never go to my parents for comfort or help. If I needed things like that, I could never ask. And then what I find out later in life through my sister Rebecca, there's actually a 12-step program called Adult Children of Alcoholics, ACA, which is a 12-step program. And, you know, all these 12-step programs, there's usually like this one, there's a laundry list of like 14 characteristics kind of identify. And when I first discovered that, probably in my late 30s, I hit on like 11 of those 14 characteristics. And it's like overly sense of responsibility, fear of authority figures. There's a whole list of problematic struggles. And so that's where I really found a lot of my recovery in.
Well, there's another piece of this too, is that when you have an angry father from a young age, you know, if you're, you know, 5 years old, a little guy, and you have this towering figure who's, you know, smoke coming out of his nose and screaming and everything, you don't have any options for escape. You're dependent on them. So it really puts a small child in a bind of being terrified by the person who's supposed to provide love and nurturance for them. You know, so what are you supposed to do? And the way that oftentimes carries over into adulthood is having trouble dealing with authority, you know, being too deferential or not standing up for yourself or speaking up when you need to, because, you know, in the back of your mind, even though you know, you know, you're talking to a peer or like your boss is your age or maybe a little older than you, they're not going to scream at you or physically attack you, but that representation is still stuck in the back of your mind and has an inhibitory force on you when you're trying to exert any boundaries.
What if that rings true for you, Clay?
So the way I describe that is frozen boy. And so I became frozen boy, frozen feelings, because it wasn't safe to be just vulnerable. So I had no feelings, right? And then this evolved until eventually I became frozen man, right? With no feelings. And then in the process of recovery for me, there's a thawing process. And oh, I have feelings of pride or sadness or joy, and learning to appreciate those. And it was really eye-opening for me to feel physical sensations like in my chest in a surge of pride or physical sensations to actual feelings. I had never experienced that as a child because there was no safety to feel physically because of what was happening emotionally, physically in the room.
I mean, I'll say this, and we all can agree on this sentiment, which is sometimes our thoughts and our feelings are a little scary, but I can imagine they might have been a little terrifying for somebody like you who was never really allowed to explore them. And then now the first, like, I'm talking about like during your recovery, right, where you're really going in there with healers and people who are trying to help you and move through some of these things. Can you articulate for some of us or to us some of those things that were a little bit challenging to grab onto and work through in the recovery process?
Sure. Yeah, one comes to mind is like real positive and one more of a struggling side. The positive side, the first of those 12-step meetings I went to, I didn't know if there would be anybody there. I'd never been in any 12-step program. And I describe it as this very quickly realized this is like a fellowship of people where we really understand each other, because we're people from different walks of life that have these same characteristics. And I felt like I was heard. I felt a sense of belonging in an hour that I never had with my family over 30 plus years, right? Mm. So driving home from that meeting, I'm crying tears of joy and worry I may run into a light pole because of the tears of joy. I can't see where I'm going, right? And then the maybe darker side of that, you fast forward about a year or two in recovery. My kids were in elementary school, and my wife and I were going through a divorce. And I had to go have a meeting with the school principal, as a woman principal, a very nice professional woman, and talking about co-parenting and the kids' homework and all that. I felt inside terrified as this little child being called into the principal's office because I did something wrong. Nothing could be further from the truth. But then I felt this viscerally, physically, you know, sweating inside. And I'm like, this is crazy. Why am I, this is my kid's school principal. You know, she's a nice person and I like this school, you know. So that really weird feeling. But I learned to honor that and respect that. This is a sign you're coming out. This is good. This is a good thing. And to be honored and respected. And okay, intellectually, I can tell myself why that is. And I'm okay. You have feelings when you have encounters with people. But one of the consequences of this ACA stuff is fear of authority figures. So that's a constant one. So principal of the school, who would have thought she's an authority figure, but I wouldn't think of it that way. But in reality, that's kind of where it comes from.
Right. You know, from
what are you thinking about? Yeah, go, David. I can see you just chomping at the bit here.
Yeah, from my experience dealing with folks, that twinge never 100% goes away. But where you learn to master it is you identify what it is. And just like you had that conversation, if you saw the big smile come over my face when you started going into that, you had the realization, it's like, wait a second, I actually like this principal. And like, this is a school that I feel connected to. Like there's no logical reason why I should feel overwhelmed with fear or intimidated, right? So like these old patterns will come back. And they're completely illogical. They don't make any sense whatsoever, but they just grab you emotionally. And exactly what you did, if you can just kind of pause for a second and recognize what's happening and then kind of talk yourself through it, remind yourself of the work that you've done to get to this point and just work through it. Like, so you're not going to be able to 100% get rid of that fear, but you keep moving forward as though it doesn't exist. And you'll be able to function through it. Yeah. But I wish I could say that it goes away. I don't think I've ever seen, well, there might be a few people, but I don't think it ever 100% goes away.
But we always talk about it. It never will go away. These things that happen to you, these big T's, little T's, whatever you want to call them, they're never going to go away. You're always going to have them in the back of your mind. It's just when they surface, what do you do with it? And I was smiling too, Clay, because I just loved what you said about, you made some comment about, I felt like a little boy in the principal's office. And that happens to people like us who experience that kind of crap growing up. That little inner child never leaves us. And for all of the things, as I say, that look, taste, touch, feel like that situation, you're bound to have that little boy experience and thought and feeling inside. But I just love how you articulate that when you feel it, that's like the sign that you're doing it right. And you're, you know, essentially kind of reparenting yourself a little bit and giving yourself what you needed back then and there. And so I hope people latched on to that because it's a fantastic tool and a fantastic thing to know as you're working through trauma. Awesome job.
Let me throw one other thing too.
Please.
For the people that are listening to this podcast, if you're at that point now where you catch yourself in those situations and then talk yourself through it and you're still able to function, if you want to level up, if you want to take it to the next level up, in the future, try to identify the situations that are likely to set off that reaction and then set your mind ahead of time, right? So if you know, going to visit an authority figure tends to give you that anxiety, before the anxiety even comes up, pause then and say, okay, I know from the past, sometimes I get a twinge of anxiety. It's going to be fine. I've been through this before. I know how this plays out. This is a friendly situation. And kind of pre-gaming it and talking yourself through it ahead of time sometimes can head off that anxiety before it even starts, right? So it's great to catch it and to talk yourself through it. But then again, one step of improvement is try to recognize the situations before and set your mind even before you go into it.
Yeah, great stuff. And thank you for saying all that you did. So back to your story, back to your upbringing, back to the ultimate writing of this memoir called My Sister's Brother. And if I'm not mistaken, what happened to your sister had a profound impact on you.
Yes, indeed.
You mind expanding a little bit on that story?
Yeah. How much time do we have? Boy. Yeah.
Yeah. Settle in, grab a cup of coffee.
Read a little passage from the opening. It kind of paints a picture of the family. So this is 1972, suburban Los Angeles, Southern California, upper middle class life. "Would you please set the table?" Mom laughed with a smile. That was usually my job. Mom's command of the kitchen was akin to conducting a full orchestra. It wouldn't be Mom's kitchen without the sound of lemons being chopped on the wooden cutting board. "Tonic is so expensive," she laughed, half joking as she poured on more gin. Mom always laughed while fixing her gin and tonic, and at most other times too. Mom was busy regaling us with her adventure du jour from the office as Dad quietly chewed his prime rib as his bourbon-soaked neurons grew dimmer and dimmer. Becky was much more outspoken than I ever was. "Someday we'll have a woman president. It's long overdue. Men have screwed up our country for long enough. Gloria Steinem is going to be speaking at UCLA next month. It's time for a change." "Bullshit, women's rights," Dad muttered as he shoveled mashed potatoes into his mouth. It was hard to tell if this was sober Dad or screaming drunk Dad. I felt my stomach tighten as I averted my gaze from both of them. I hoped that was enough to make them stop. "Clay, have some more sweet potatoes and ham." Mom smiled as she pushed the bowls in front of me, blocking the full-on battle. I felt myself exhale in silence. At the same time this was all happening, at countless other dinner tables in the valley, moms and dads were undoubtedly having conversations with their kids about their relationships at school, their future goals and aspirations, how they feel about themselves and others. But at the Jones house, although the house was in the right neighborhood and the food was delicious, the adult occupants were mere shadows of loving, compassionate parents, like a reflection in a mirror. But a crazy circus funhouse mirror at that. Nothing on the inside is as it appears on the outside. My big sister, Linda, 12 years older, was noticeably absent. We were always close. When Linda and I were together, I felt different. I felt loved, peaceful, accepted. We laughed. Linda lived in her own apartment not far away, but never came for dinner. And she called him Charles, which was odd. As the youngest in the family, I never asked why. I knew that sort of talk was not okay. Mom gleefully proclaimed, "This week, Mr. Leach has kept me so busy. He's the most brilliant attorney I've ever worked for. Most legal secretaries can't type as fast as me. I go as fast as the machine, 100 words per minute, and no mistakes. Mr. Leitch says I'm the best secretary he's ever had, and he can choose whoever he wants." Sailing on her magic flying typewriter, Mom spared no expense, proclaiming how happy she was. The gin didn't hurt, but even lightning-fast typewriters need to be oiled from time to time. It's a good thing Mom can type that fast. If one of her kids is drowning, she can always throw her typewriter in the water to save them. After all, it can spell out the really hard words, such as, "My husband, Charles, sexually abused and raped our daughter, Linda, from age 8 to 20, but we just pretend it never happened." The words that she could never say to anyone. I suppose it would be hard to say that while laughing. And besides, you might spill your gin and tonic. And tonic is so expensive.
David, if you don't mind, I have a question. Because one of the things that hit me about that opening or the excerpt from your book is that Linda's the one that you feel the most peace and love when you're around. However, due to the circumstances with her and your dad, she's not coming around. She doesn't want to be anywhere near that situation. And so when she moved out, was that kind of the end of you seeing her in any kind of consistent way?
No, it was actually not, because she didn't live too far away. And the things we would do, we were Dodgers fans, we'd go to the Dodger games and go to the beach, you know, and that was our thing in Southern California. That's a lot of people in LA did, you know, in those days.
During your childhood, did she ever talk to you about what happened? Like, when did that come to the, when did you become aware of what it happened between your sister and your dad?
When she was 45, she was diagnosed with breast cancer. And those that are familiar with ACEs, adverse childhood experiences, believe this is a direct connect the dots right here. And she passed away about a year and a half later. During that time, our other sister, Rebecca, 4 years older, was her confidant and caretaker and to the doctor. And she confided a lot of this to Rebecca at that time. And one of the ways she described it to Rebecca, she said regarding Dad, she said, "A little happened a lot, and a lot happened a little."
Did you ever suspect that something was wrong? Like, what was your understanding of why your sister left the house?
Right. There was just a couple of weird things. She referred to him as Charles by his name. She didn't call him Dad. And the reason the story is called My Sister's Brother, I was not sure whether I was her biological brother or not, or half brother or what. And that was one of those things we don't talk about. But she was my sister. We had the same birth parents. So that's kind of how that went. But she confided in Becky. I think that throughout her life, Linda was very protective of me, looking in hindsight. And I think she thought that if she, one of the things I write, I think that if she thought that if she had told me, I would have killed him. And maybe I would have.
Yeah. Is your dad's not around any longer?
He died when I was 18, so he was 72. When he was 54 when I was born. So, and a chronic smoker and a heavy drinker finally took its toll. I'm surprised he lived as long as he did.
Right. Because I can still feel the way that you feel about him and the way that you talk about him. But I wonder about, has any piece of your relationship with him shifted in death?
It has. And what I say about that is learning about forgiveness. And most people say, well, I could never forgive. I will never forgive, you know. And with a lot of spiritual practice and work and soul searching, I realized that it's something that I do for me. And I write about how, you know, I learned how to forgive my parents. And honestly, it changed my life.
I need you to expand on that, man. How many people are out there right now that need the same kind of assistance? So what worked for you?
Yeah. So both of my parents were long dead by that time. And again, people think that, you know, I need to go to the person and, you know, forgive them or some kind of amends. And really, what if the person you want to forgive is no longer living? Are you just stuck in purgatory or something? You know, so it's an inside job. It's an inside job that we do ourselves, regardless of whether that other person is alive or dead or in our life or not. To me, it makes no difference. And because I saw how much that in itself was eating away at me. You know, it's like an internal cancer, you know, and these freaking parents, you know, if only, you know. And I want to be a healthier man. And I've worked in social work 25 years. I want to help other families. I want to be healthy for that role. And I've helped other dads. And, you know, talking about, you know, that fear of authority thing. So I've had situations where I've had male clients older with gray hair that remind me of that, right? So as a professional, how do I approach this? You know, another level of that fear of authority, but understanding, okay, those feelings in me, now they're welcomed. That's part of who I am. That was this frozen boy, but I'm not frozen boy. I'm not frozen man anymore. And I'm mature and professional. I'm intelligent. I want to help this person be healthier and have healthier relationships. And I'll do what I can for that.
You mentioned that you're a father. Do you have, how many kids do you have?
I do. I have a son and a daughter. My daughter is recently married. So I have a son-in-law, so young adult kids. We were married for about 15 years. We divorced when they were 8 and 11. It was around the time that I started this ACA recovery work. It was around the time I discovered that. It was during the divorce.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me too much, just because of that work is really deep and it's hard, and it does require sometimes a very massive shift in scenery, environment, people, all of the things. Like, it just kind of feels like you have to go through all that. But Dr. Dame, don't you feel like we kind of have an opportunity here to dig a little deeper on this whole thing? Because I do... It's real easy to sit here and talk about all the bad things that happened to us growing up. It's another to point to that stuff, because look at this, man. Like, let's just be very real, Clay. That horrible scene growing up made you the best fucking social worker on planet Earth. Mm-hmm. Like, you think about things, you are tuned into things, you are way ahead of the curve in that field because of the kinds of things you experience. And I think that's a byproduct of the way you grew up, right? So I really want to drill down on that a little, David, and I would love to hear what you think about it.
Yeah, you know, from living through those situations and then learning how to come through it on the other side, you can identify the patterns from miles away. You know, so when you see somebody else who's stuck or you know, you just know some of the patterns of avoidance, some of the shiny false optimism that sometimes can be hiding something dark below the surface. You know, you can pick those things out with little effort. It rings true because you've lived through it. You know, and we were talking about forgiveness. You know, Matt and I have been talking about forgiveness quite a bit, kind of offline. You highlighted something that we had touched on in our personal discussions about sometimes forgiveness just means that you have to let it go. You know, there's no way to correct the situation that happened. The person who was involved, who caused the offense, is not going to come around. Maybe they're not able to come around. You know, so and what they did is not right, and forgiveness doesn't mean acknowledging that what they did was okay. It's never okay. So really the forgiveness part is just for you. It's releasing it so that you can move forward and have that burden lifted from your shoulders.
Well, and Clay, I'm going to bet that you were a very different kind of father because of your experiences too. Can we talk about that?
Sure. I like to think I'm a good dad. Hopefully I was. It's an honor. It's a privilege walking my daughter down the aisle 3 years ago. Holy cow, 300 people in the wedding party. One of the thrills of my life, and what an honor. And I love my son-in-law, you know, and it's still to this day, it's just a joy. So, yeah. And the social work part, you know, David probably knows in social work, there's a lot of burnout. People suffer vicarious trauma, we call it, as workers. We take on the traumas of all the trauma we work with, right? We get burned out. And I wondered for a while, I never experienced that, and I wondered why. And I think it's kind of like you're saying, and the way I describe it is there's a lot of fuel in this tank. You know, I don't feel burnout. Now I take care of myself. I don't work 100 hours a week. I don't rescue the world. I did that the first 5 years of my career. I felt completely responsible for all child abuse cases in Maricopa County for 5 years. I felt I was responsible for that. Then I entered the recovery part of it. I don't feel that anymore. But, you know, and the funny thing about that is, I honestly can't imagine doing any other kind of work. I could not imagine selling tires or working in a restaurant or, you know, and I love pizza. I love having good tires on my car. Those are important things. But to me, it just seems, I don't want to say meaningless, but I'm just like, I couldn't do that. And I'm like, this is important stuff. And we can't we can't help everybody we reach, but you know, we sure try, and we try to get better at it. And so I tell people there's a lot of fuel in my tank.
What I think one of the things that gives you gas in the tank is having worked through some of this. You know, if you're keeping secrets, keeping family secrets, keeping things hidden, you know, somebody brings up a topic that's sensitive and you quickly change the subject, you know, that type of avoidance, burnout is inevitable, you know, because especially if you're doing social work or therapy or anything like that, where, you know, you're dealing with people that are struggling with things, and inevitably there's going to be some situations that ring true to your own story. If you have to avoid that, it becomes very taxing. But working through things to the point where you can talk about it, you can address it, you can kind of tap into some of that experience to help other people, I think that's where, you know, you're taking the lump of coal and squeezing it into a diamond at that point. You're really making something valuable out of the traumatic experiences and being able to use it. And it's energizing. It feels good to be able to do that for people.
Yeah. Does it feel that way for you, Clay?
Yeah. When my kids were younger, you know, I'd take them to the office and their job was shredding paper. Because they're like 8 years old. You can't say, hey, kids, let me tell you about the baby I had with a fractured skull today. You know, what did you do today? You know? And so one day when my daughter was about 8 or 9, we were talking about what you want to be when you get big. And she's so wise. She said, Daddy, she says, I want to do what you do. And I'm like, what is it exactly you think that I do, Miss 8 year old? You know, she said, you help families with problems. So even at that age, she knew that. And now you fast forward, she's in nursing school now. And now, you know, obviously they understand and they're adults. We can talk about more of those things. Yeah. So it's been an interesting kind of come around as a parent.
I'm energized, man. I kind of jump on the back of what Dr. Dave said. It's just so refreshing to hear how people cycled through difficult situations, because it just offers so many people who are in the same space a possible solution, you know, for what they're dealing with themselves. You've got this short version of your recovery story that was just published in a new e-magazine for survivors. It's called My Sister's Brother. As we start to wind down our conversation, are there pieces, or what is the piece of this memoir that you're really hoping stays with people and sticks with people?
There is all kinds of help out there. And 12-step may be or may not be therapy, maybe, or there may be a bowling league of guys that support each other. There may be something at church, you know. There is all kinds of things. What the common thread they have is relationships. You know, we can't recover in solitary confinement. You know, we got to be connected with other people. I get connected with, like, my tribe, this ACA, this 12-step program, these people. We share these common 14 traits, different degrees. But you look around, they're men, women, they're different ages, races, religions, and we look so different, but yet we have these common threads. We start reading and sharing our stories, like, oh my God, that's my story, what you're saying right there. That's the same thing. So I would like people to know there is help available, and there's a lot of men in these groups. We're probably 50% of us are men in this particular program. I never really thought about it, but there's a lot of guys. It's not just women. And this is one of the subjects of this podcast, is how do we get the message out, kind of a call to action for men to know, yeah, bad shit happened, and we don't have to just cover it up with a 12-pack of something and you know, buck up and go on, because it has consequences. It has consequences on our health. It has consequences on our relationship, on our behavior, all kinds of things. And so it's worth the effort. It's worth the effort. When I entered recovery, it scared the crap out of me, you know, the idea. And I was really kind of angry for a moment. I thought, you know, oh, this is where I'm at. Oh, the bad news, the solution is to become, you said it, become your own loving parent. Well, I don't want to be my own loving parent. I had parents, they were assholes, you know. I don't want to have to do that. But that in this situation, that's the solution. So there are solutions depending on what kind of program you're in. But ultimately, it's about connecting and having healthy relationships with other folks. And many folks, you might feel like you're the only one. This story of mine, it's a very unique story, but there's thousands of people growing up with parents with alcoholism and incest and sexual abuse and who knows, all other kinds of things. And there's lots of good people out there that are getting healthier. And, you know, that door is open. You know, there's no price to admission. Drive on over and you know, have that leap of faith. It's a little bit of a courage, and especially for men.
If I could switch gears for a bit, you know, one of the things that jumped out at me was that you have to push past the shame. You know, growing up in a family with alcoholism and sexual abuse, there's a lot of shame and a lot of secrets. And that shame, that feeling of shame, you know, feeling that there's something defective about you or that you don't want the family secret to get out, or maybe your parents even frankly put it on you, hey, you can't talk about any of this stuff. You know, carrying that burden around keeps you isolated from other people. It keeps you from having healthy relationships. You know, one of the things that you had mentioned before about, you know, maybe joining a bowling league or getting involved with your church, that's the value of restorative relationships. You know, you find relationships with other people where the interactions give you a chance to experience something that you missed from childhood and a chance to repair some of those relationship aspects that were damaged when you were younger. You get a chance to live it out and see what it's supposed to be like. So those restorative relationships are important, but you can't get to that point if you're harboring shame. You know, you have to find a way to put that aside.
Love that. And I've gotten to say this 100 or so times over the last couple of years, but how about it? Three men getting on Zoom to talk about their feelings. I freaking love it, man. And I more of it needs to happen. And I want to echo as we wrap up what you said, Clay, which is something that we've talked a lot about on this podcast, in that feeling that you cannot heal without relationship. And I just love how you said, I love too, like Dave did, that you said the bowling thing. Because so many times we think like, my life sucks, I'm broken, I need to get fixed, I need a therapist or a psychiatrist, or I need to go to a counselor. And yeah, that could be very, very true for a lot of people. But there's some of us who just need to find a freaking great bowling league with some people who love to laugh and have had some shared experiences like we are. So we just feel like we're not the only ones out there. Right, guys?
Yeah. The bowling league can become like the psychiatrist's couch in a way.
Yeah.
Right? So similar to, you know, taking a walk with somebody and having a conversation. You're both looking forward. You're not making eye contact with each other. So in a way, you can talk freely and just speak off the top of your head, and you're not looking at the other person's reaction and waiting for approval before you continue. You just spill it out there. You know, and with the bowling league, you're sitting next to each other. You're not necessarily making eye contact. You're just talking about whatever. You get little breaks to go up and bowl, right? So it's not this constant, intense discussion all the time. You can talk about it. You can dip into something a little difficult, and then dip out of it for a little bit to go throw the ball, right? So the format of that lends itself to developing relationships and maybe even touching on some difficult subjects.
It's a great place to end. Clay, thank you so much for spending some time with us today on our podcast, Learn From People Who Lived It. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me. I really, really enjoyed this.